Aloha, it's Tuesday, June 2nd. This is Robbie Dingman, in for Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. Hawaii farmers got hit hard by the Kona low storms. Agricultural advocates give us an update on what's being done to help them recover. Today is the deadline for Hawaii residents to officially file as candidates for state and local elections this year. We take a look at some of the spicier races and watch for last-minute surprises. One small step for UH? We learn about the proposed revival of a space program on the slopes of Mauna Loa. Plus, amid rising tensions in the Pacific, top military brass from the U.S. and China convene in Hawaii. And we hear from a playwright collecting memory beads to keep family stories alive for future generations.
She's crazy, she got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Well, that's one way to lose these walking blues.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Robbie Dingman. The Kona low storms pounded many Hawaii farms, with damage estimates soaring to $50 million as growers across the state surveyed the wake of destruction left by the heavy rains. Already feeling the loss of $90 million in federal agricultural funds, Hawaii farmers are feeling the need for critical support more than ever. HPR's Mark Ladau has been following this story, both in the muddy fields of the North Shore and at the state legislature, and he's here today to give us the latest. Mark, tell us what's going on with ag.
Hi, Robbie. Yeah, so you're right. I was in the field during the storm, but a lot of the story that I had out today covered the legislation and the funding that went through the state capitol, so a little less muddy in there. But it was...
It's a different kind of mud.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes, you're right. And advocates and even lawmakers who work with agriculture and food security, they were pretty happy this year. Everything considered, with the policy and the funding that they got, and you know, just like you mentioned, there was the Kona low storms, which was kind of a big deal, kind of threw a wrench in everything. There was also last year there was the government shutdown. There was all this money, something like $90 million, that Hawaii lost from USDA funding, and then there's, you know, all of this uncertainty around SNAP, things like that. There's a lot when it comes to food security and agriculture that Hawaii lost. And, you know, it was kind of juggle how to support agriculture during the session. But yeah, they were still able to do it is what a lot of people said. And that's something they were really excited about. And we'll go through some of what
yeah,
did
maybe
pass.
You can help us sort out some of the things that were more important, because I know that you cover the legislature all the time. And so you can help us figure out which ones are more important.
Right. Yeah. One thing maybe we could start with is there was a bill that gave the State Agribusiness Development Corporation the power or the ability to acquire private land through eminent domain. The ADC, you know, it's tasked with transforming ag land into diversified agriculture. And using this with this ability, it can take more of that land and bring it into farming. There was some controversy around it. You know, the eminent domain is kind of a big power, authority to give any entity. But I was talking to the House Ag Chair, Corey Chun, who supported the bill. And he said what it does is allow for this thing called friendly condemnation, which allows there to be negotiations. So the state can't just take away that land for farming.
The government and the owner come to an agreement on a price. So you don't have to go to court to get determined just compensation because you already agreed upon it. The benefit of that is actually for the landowner, because they actually get a tax benefit from that. So in my mind, this is like another acquisition tool that's a win-win, because the state can then acquire land, ADC can then acquire agricultural land to preserve it, but then the landowner also gets his tax benefit where they don't have to pay the taxes on the gain as long as they transfer it to another property.
Okay, so that helps get more land into ag. What are some of the other things that passed the legislature that are helping farmers?
Yeah, there is another bill. This one is also, it's been sort of in talks at the legislature for a few years. This would set up a reimbursement pilot program for farmers when they transport goods within the state. That's obviously another expense. And so when they have to ship their farming commodities, or even when they have to ship supplies necessary for farming, this program would let them get reimbursed for that. And shipping is obviously more expensive. Just costs in general for everybody is getting more expensive. So that's supposed to be super helpful. And there's a bunch of little things too that were supported or funded. Like there's a grant writer for the Department of Agriculture and Biosecurity. The department only has one grant writer.
I know. Grant writing is a thing. If you learn how to do it, I think you can write your ticket.
And you know, there's been talks for a few years about how there's all this federal money that the state sort of as a whole hasn't gotten because they don't have anyone to get those grants or write them or just apply for them. So they don't want to leave that money on the table as much as possible. As far as food security measures, there are a couple of bills that would make SNAP, or formerly known as food stamps, easier to get access to, particularly for Kupuna and inmates. The one for Kupuna would extend the recertification period, so they would apply for SNAP every 3 years. Right now, they have to do it every year, so it's a lot of time or a lot they have to do. It's a lot of paperwork, so it makes things easier.
Okay, so it streamlines that for mm-hmm. Kupuna and also for inmates who are coming out of the system and coming back into society. That's great. So
yeah,
that's helpful.
There's a separate bill, and it would make it easier for them so they can get benefits as soon as they are released, which is obviously helpful. There is also funding for the Farm to Families program that gives money to local food banks. Obviously, they help reduce farm insecurity in Hawaii, but it funds them to buy local produce, so it also helps farmers. The program got $1 million last year, but Daniela, or between the last 2 years, but Daniela Spoto, director. Deputy Director for Hawaii Appleseed said the extra funding is actually big for them.
That had already passed last year, but this year there was a bill going through to increase the funding because the $500,000 was sort of barely enough to make a dent. And we were able to actually increase that another $898,000 on top of that $500,000. It's super exciting. And I know the food banks are happy, the farmers. Going to be great for strengthening those connections between the emergency food system and farmers.
I know the green fee got some controversy over what it did not fund, but for ag, there are a few things that weren't on the minds of the green folks, the climate folks, but they were good for agriculture. What other things do you want to mention real quickly about what passed?
Yeah, there was funding from the green fee, and a lot of that was for infrastructure. There was also funding for school kitchens, fixes to things like the Wahiwa Dam, which obviously almost overfilled during the recent Kona low, and then money for fixing irrigation systems. I talked with Senator Tim Richards, who chairs the Senate Committee on Agriculture and Environment. He said a lot of this infrastructure funding is really important going forward.
It's more than just growing something or grazing something, because I take it a step further. We have to talk about the infrastructure needs. And with that infrastructure needs comes the overall economy. For the most part, most of the economic growth or economic impact of agriculture comes in the value added. So that's why you keep hearing me talk about value added, infrastructure, infrastructure, infrastructure.
Well, thanks, Mark. That's a lot for us to hear about, and we hope you're going to continue covering agriculture.
Yes, I will. Thank you, Robbie.
All right. Well, thank you. We've been hearing from HPR's Mark Ladau. To listen to more of his coverage of agriculture across the islands, head to hawaiipublicradio.org.
half ago, Indonesia launched a nationwide free lunch program in schools to fight childhood malnutrition. That program feeds millions of people, but there's a big problem.
The kitchen staff don't have proper training for hygiene to prepare food properly.
And the food is making tens of thousands of people sick. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
On the next Fresh Air, novelist Maggie O'Farrell. She wrote the book Hamnet and co-wrote the screenplay for the film adaptation. She has a new book called Land, about a father and son mapping 19th century Ireland after the devastation of the Great Famine. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
Just 5 hours until the filing deadline for candidates to appear on the ballot this fall. More than 100 offices are up for election this year, including governor, lieutenant governor, and Maui and Kauai mayors. As we count down the minutes to 4:30, we're joined by Honolulu Civil Beat's Chad Blair. Good morning, my friend.
Hey, Robbie. Good to be on with you.
Yeah, you too. Always a pleasure to talk politics with another politics nerd. Let's jump into some of the races that are shaping up to be competitive. What's high on your list?
Yeah, there's several. I think I would probably put right at the top the race between Ed Case, the incumbent in the 1st Congressional District, that's pretty much urban Oahu, and State Senator Jared Keahokalole. This is the Democratic primary. This was looking to be pretty much a walk for Case because there was another candidate in that primary as well, but Della Albalotti ended up dropping out just recently. So now it really is a one-on-one with Keahokalole against Case, Case being a more moderate Democrat, Keahokalole a little bit more on the progressive side. So that could be really interesting. And speaking of Della Albalotti, the state rep, she now is running for lieutenant governor against Kauai Mayor Derek Kawakami and Honolulu attorney John Choi. There's still a few others. Mm-hmm. As you said, we got 5 hours before the filing deadline. But those two races, the LG and the CD1, are right at the top of my list.
Right. And on the Ed Case race, it was seen that with two competitors who are up and coming, yeah. with Della Albalotti and Jared Keahokalole, both in the race, that they would have just split any people who were looking for someone other than Ed Case.
That was strongly the opinion. I think we're basically dipping into the same pool. But now with Belotti, who, by the way, will be leaving the legislature after 20 years, out of that race, it makes it much easier. Not saying it's a done deal, but one other thing that Keahokalole has going for him is he doesn't actually have to resign to run because his state Senate seat is not open until 2 years from now. So that is certainly to be a competitive race. Who knows, maybe a new face. Although, let me just say this, it is rare, extremely rare, for an incumbent congressional delegate to lose election. I think Charles DeJue is the only person whose name comes to mind.
Yes, I agree with you. Hawaii is reluctant to ditch an incumbent unless there's usually some other specific reason. Yeah. Or if you look statewide, I think there have been other cases where incumbents have been booted, but it has been more of a disconnect. And speaking of incumbents and interesting races, talk a little bit about the Maui mayor race.
Well, this is really the race in so many, really more than any other race that I can think of on Maui County. That's really going to be a barn burner. That's Richard Bisson, the current incumbent, as well as challenged by Councilwoman Yuki Sugimura. There's others that may jump into that race as well. I mean, we all know what's happened on Maui the last 4 years, the Lahaina fires, a terrible tragedy. The fight over Bill 9 with the short-term rentals being converted. There's no shortage of issues to talk about. And Sugimura is picking up some union endorsements. So Bisson has his share as well. But that is really going to be something to watch. By the way, regardless of who wins the primary. They don't really win. The top two, if I remember correctly, on Maui County will actually advance to the general election. So we'll see whether it's Bisson or Sugimura or who else, but that's a race to watch.
Right. That's interesting because you've got the primary and then the general, so they can't, they, it stays interesting, unlike some of the other results where people are, it's often decided in the primary in a state that's so heavily Democratic.
Depends on the county, but it's 50% for plus one, I believe, on Hawaii County, but it all depends. And then, of course, over on Kauai, in order to replace Derek Kawakami, who's term limited, you have the former mayor, Bernard Carvalho, who's now on the council. You have Mel Raposo, who's also on the council and has run for mayor before. They're going against each other, but as with the case on Maui, there are other competitors. Councilwoman Felicia Cowden is in that race, too. I believe she has now formally filed. So that's a race to be watching as well. How exciting. By the way, just on a side note, to have female candidates vying for mayor of two of our counties, I think is terrific to have more representation. Not saying that's an endorsement, just simply pointing out.
fair. It's true. And then you wanted to mention a little bit about the county council race, speaking of rematches.
Yeah, Trevor Ozawa, who formerly was on the council in Honolulu here, former chair, going against Tommy Waters. I believe this will be their third match. I'd have to go back. There was one that went to court, I think. They had to do a recount. It was kind of complicated, but that...
Sure, in the special election, yeah. There was
exactly,
that might have thrown off your count there.
That's exactly what threw off my count. That's exciting to see, because that's the top seat really there, because Tommy Waters is the chair. That's here on Oahu. So yeah, it's going to be, I thought it was going to be a bit of a snoozer, but it's looking like we're going to have a pretty good primary season.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. You preempted my last question, which was looking ahead. What are you seeing about this race? Is it an interesting one? And you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, and maybe some in the general as well, particularly if President Wall, the state senator, takes on Jill Takuda. So
yeah.
Stay tuned, Robbie. It's going to be fun.
Well, buckle up, Chad. That sounds great. Thank you so much for your help. I appreciate it, and I look forward to talking again. Take care,
my
friend. We've been hearing from Honolulu Civil Beat editor Chad Blair. You can read more of his coverage at civilbeat.org. NASA missions may soon return to the slopes of Mauna Loa. For nearly a decade, the U.S. Space Agency funded research and missions at a Hawaii Island test site built to simulate the surface of the Moon and Mars. The site is called High Seas. It stands for the Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation, and organizers have secured NASA funding to upgrade the research station after a hiatus. A public comment period recently ended for a draft environmental assessment of the project. The university is expected to submit a final environmental assessment to the state later this summer. Kim Binstead is a professor in the Information and Computer Science Department at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. She spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about plans for the High Seas program. Binstead starts by explaining what it is.
So High Seas is an analog site. And what that means is it's a place that is like space, like Mars, like the Moon, in ways that are useful when you're trying to do research. So in this case, High Seas is a Mars-like, primarily, site in the saddle area of the Big Island on the slopes of Mauna Loa at about 8,000 feet. And what we specialize in there is long-duration simulations. So because the weather and the conditions at the site are so stable, we've done simulations up to 12 months in length. And you can think of them as a dress rehearsal for space exploration. Our crews do the kinds of things astronauts would do. They have the kinds of constraints astronauts would have, and they essentially do a dress rehearsal for space.
High level, the questions that missions are trying to answer. I mean, the basic one is how will humans react to long periods in space, right?
That's right. Yeah. So our focus, our funding in the past has always been about behavioral health and performance, which is essentially astronaut psychology. So will they continue to stay psychologically healthy enough to do the things they need to do to have a safe mission? And the thing to emphasize here is when you've got any space mission is a system of systems. You've got the rockets, you've got the life support, you've got all of the bits of engineering that contribute to having a safe mission. And the humans are part of that. If the human part goes wrong, it can be just as dangerous as if the rocket blows up.
What kinds of answers have you gotten? What would you say is the legacy of the research that you've done with high seas?
Well, there's lots of details, but I would say some of the big picture lessons are that humans have conflicts. Even the most stoic, psychologically stable, well-trained, well-educated, well-prepared crews are going to have conflicts. We would have liked to have been able to tell NASA, look, just don't bring this kind of person on and you won't have any conflicts. But humans have conflicts, especially over the long term. Some people can tough it out over a few weeks or a few days, but if you're going to have a 2.5 year long mission to Mars and back, for example, you're going to have conflict. So instead of trying to avoid conflict altogether, what you do is you choose and you train and you support for resiliency. So for the ability for a group of people, both individually and as a team, to come back from conflict and return to a high functioning level. I'd say that's one of the big picture lessons. Between 2012 and 2019, we had three rounds of NASA funding, which was fantastic. Each one was 3 years. We did multiple missions and got lots of results. Then NASA turned its attention, this is very natural, to a slightly different target. They got focused on what's now the Artemis program and returning people to the surface of the moon, which asks different questions from the kind that we were designed to answer. So the project sort of went on, I would call, hiatus for a few years. There were still activities there, but it wasn't the NASA-funded research that we'd been doing to date. Now, this last year, we just received another NASA grant to make modifications to the habitat. So the new grant is focused on making it adaptable to different mission scenarios. So before, when we focused just on the surface of Mars, now they want us to say, okay, well, what if instead of 6 people on Mars, we want 4 people on the moon? Or what if we want 2 people in transit from the Earth to the moon, or on a space station orbiting the moon? And so the idea is that the habitat can serve these other mission profiles as well, instead of just the long duration Mars missions we started looking at.
Let's talk about a few of these proposed features. And I will say, the way I found out about this, it was in a draft environmental assessment that was published. Quoting from the draft EA here, a 1,000-gallon propane tank to supplement solar power, modular plant growth chambers for food and oxygen production, and a low solar angle illumination setup to simulate lunar conditions for 1 to 3 hour night missions. What does this mean and what's it for?
Well, so, you know, the propane generator, we've always had one. So this is basically getting it properly included in the EA going forward. So that's not really part of the NASA-funded upgrades. The plant growth chamber is really exciting. So any long-duration mission, the food, and we've been looking at food since the beginning of high seas, the food is going to include some combination of food brought from Earth, presumably dried, food and food produced on the surface, whichever surface we're going to. So there's a lot of interesting questions about how you best produce food, plant food in particular, under those circumstances. So what we're hoping to do, and this is really an opportunity for UH students to do some research, UH faculty to do some research. So what we're planning to do is to put in a plant growth chamber, which is effectively sealed from the environment, so no escaping of seeds or of bugs or anything like that, and to test the various approaches that have been proposed to plant growth. And again, our focus is on longer durations. It's all very well to set up, you know, a little plant growth chamber in a laboratory, but if the astronauts are not going to be able to maintain it, if they're not able to do any necessary repairs and get the kind of nutrition out of it that they need, then it's not going to be much use. So that's one of the things we're looking at. The lunar surface lighting part is something that got a lot of scrutiny, and I want to make it clear what we're talking about. So in the polar regions of the moon, the light is very shallowly angled. So you get these very long, dark shallows. When combined with the albedo, the reflectiveness of the moon makes it really hard to walk around. Well, we assume. We haven't had people walking around in the lunar areas yet, but we're pretty sure that it's going to be challenging to navigate. So what we would like to do is, in a very limited way, try to reflect that around the habitat very briefly. So what we're planning is a couple of times a year to have some low-level lights in the immediate vicinity of the habitat to try and reproduce some of that kind of lighting. Now, there's a lot of provisos there. The albedo, the reflectiveness of the area around the habitat is nowhere near the moon. The surface is quite different material. So we're only going to be able to do it in a very limited way. Also, it's very important not to interfere with the telescopes, not to interfere with the bird life in the area. So again, we're talking about something very limited, effectively the equivalent of pointing car headlights at the side of the hill. Please don't imagine it as something grandiose. And we are being very careful to make sure that the telescope folks and the bird folks know what we're planning and agree with our contingency plans and can call a halt to it if they have any concerns.
Just on that note of sensitivity, has the project felt different to you at all now in the context of the Mauna Kea activism, the protests against the 30-meter telescope?
Not really. A lot of that was happening while we were still in operation, you know, in the sort of 2017, 2018, 2019 period. We have not had any protests, and I hope that is because we've been good neighbors, that we've done everything we can to respect the land and to keep any impact we have to an absolute bare minimum. So one thing to understand is this land was disturbed before we came along. So the cinder cone where the habitat is was mined to build the Mauna Loa access road. So it was already flat land. All the habitat really is a big tent that was dropped onto the flat land. And when we go away, it will be the same as it was when we got there. So that's important. Also, I just need to be clear as well that our crews are all given Hawaiian cultural training when they arrive. They learn not just about the geology of the land, but the history of the land and the culture associated with it. And we really do everything we in our power to be respectful and to be good users of the land.
Why is that specific area so important for the kinds of questions you're asking, and why does it offer a unique opportunity for investigating some of these questions about like mimicking spaceflight conditions and human isolation and the surface of Mars and or the moon?
So one thing is there are other analogs. So there's analogs in Utah. There's an analog station in Utah. There's ones at the North Pole, there's ones at the South Pole, and each of those focus on different kinds of research. What the High Sea Site is extremely strong at is long-duration studies in a geologically appropriate environment. So the area, Mars has shield volcanoes. Mauna Loa is, of course, a shield volcano. The area around the habitat is similar geologically to the surface of a young Mars. There's lava tubes. There's lava tubes on the moon and on Mars. So all of those things make it a really attractive place to do this kind of research. Also, just in terms of simple logistics, you can imagine that in an Antarctic analog, if a crew member has any issues, you know, they have appendicitis is something that's come up there, it can be really hazardous and it can be really hard for them to be evacuated. Whereas what's really lovely about the Mauna Loa site is that if there's an incident at the habitat, we can evacuate people quickly. And I know this sounds sort of counterintuitive, but the fact that it's a little bit safer means that we can push them harder. We can have research questions that would be very hard to answer in a very, very isolated and dangerous place like Antarctica, because it simply wouldn't be ethical to push the crew that hard. So we have a little bit more leeway to ask some really hard questions about human behavioral health and performance. Also, just one last thing is the fact that we're in Hawaii, so in the U.S., that helps. And also the fact that the weather there doesn't change drastically over the course of a year. You know, if you have an analog in Antarctica or in Utah, the conditions in summer and the conditions in winter are vastly different. And we don't really want that. We want to have nice, stable conditions.
Do you think that you'll see humans go to Mars within your lifetime?
Oh, I really hope so. One of the frustrations of the whole Humans to Mars quest is it's been 20 years in the future for the last 40 years. You know, when I was 10, I thought we would see it in the next 20 years. And here I am in my mid-50s, and I'm very much hoping we'll see it in the next 20 years.
Yeah. Anything else that you want listeners to know at this stage? So UH will be getting together an application by the end of the summer and submitting that for just the permitting process, but things to look out for or things that you wish listeners knew?
Well, one thing is I feel like there's this maybe perception that money spent on space is spent in space. And, you know, that's not true. We don't send rockets full of money up into space to burn. So this grant is being spent in Hawaii. It's being spent on people working in construction, people working at the university, people working in Hilo. And also it's being spent on the education of our students. So the HiSEA site isn't just about, I don't know, elite scientists coming and doing their special pet projects. We have both the undergraduate, graduate, and to some degree high school students carrying out their research at the site. Also, we have a lot of education and public outreach coming from the site and coming from HiSEA. So I really believe that we return a lot of value to the state of Hawaii. And I would like to make sure that everyone knows that.
That was Kim Binstead of the University of Hawaii HiSEA program talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have links to learn more about the program on our website later today.
Age and income don't matter when it comes to supporting HPR. Whether you're 23 or 83, you can make a meaningful gift to HPR through your will, trust, or other estate plan. You can even name the station as a beneficiary of a life insurance policy or retirement plan. And when you do, let us know so we can recognize you in our Legacy Society. Learn more and get started at hawaiipublicradio.org/legacy.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the Master of Human Resources Management. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu/executive.
Late last week, military officials from the U.S. and China met here on Oahu to talk about strategies in the Western Pacific. To find out more about these discussions, we are talking with Kevin Nodell, staff writer from the Honolulu Star-Advertiser. Kevin, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Robbie.
We'd like to ask you to help us understand what's going on, and why is this significant? Why are these talks significant?
Well, we don't know really that much about the specifics that they talked about. This is part of a mechanism that they kind of put into place back in the 90s in 1998 to discuss how Chinese and American forces interact if they encounter each other at sea, whether in a vessel or in an aircraft. At this point, though, I think the important thing is that they are talking, because at various points over the last few years, we've seen these talks be suspended, scheduled talks not taking place. So what we don't know specifically what the content of the conversation was, both sides have confirmed that it did take place. And the Chinese side described it as being frank and constructive.
And how often do these – are these annual usually?
Well, like I said, they're supposed to be. But at various points over the last few years, we've seen instances in which the Chinese side was a no-show, or they broke off all military and climate talks for a while in 2022 after then Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan. It hasn't always been consistent, the degree to which the two militaries have spoken directly, and certainly not face-to-face.
For sure. And then knowing how secretive all military operations tend to be, how is it that you learn more about what goes on? What is your process for getting to know more about what's going on with these talks?
Well, I guess with this one specifically, it's looking at what else has been going on. These talks kind of happened at the same time as the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore, which is a very large meeting of military and diplomatic officials bringing people over to that country. Most of that took place in public. You can watch the remarks that took place. And you know, that's an annual event, and it kind of laid out. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth was there, talked about American priorities in the Pacific and in the region, and kind of delivered their vision for what they want to see going forward.
But whereas before it was a more combative tone, this one didn't seem as much so?
A little. This year, they had some of the standard things about wanting to see China respect international regulations on shipping, respect other countries' territorial claims, respect American presence in the region. He reaffirmed that the United States considers itself a Pacific country. But it was much less combative. Last year, in particular, he was very overt, calling China aggressive, saying that it was a imminent threat to Taiwan. This year, during his remarks, didn't even mention Taiwan, though it came up a little bit in the question and answer portion.
What would you expect to be the next steps? The next time that will be the next time they're meeting here, or will you hear interim updates of these, how relations are going?
Hard to say. We hear about these meetings sometimes. Sometimes they don't. They announce this one after the fact, but we don't know about what the content of all these talks really looks like. Really, though, it just kind of depends also on events going on in the region. Tensions between the Chinese and the Philippines are a major issue in the South China Sea, critical waterway that a third of all international trade goes through. And the Philippines is a treaty ally with the United States, so that could potentially alter things. And also the question of Taiwan, which is the elephant in the room.
Yeah. I know sometimes we also ask you about how you can tell about what the relations are like by who's in the different war games.
Yeah, that's definitely true. The United States has been working much more closely with the Philippines and Japan specifically, which you'll notice geographically are two countries very close to Taiwan. U.S. troops from Hawaii were training just 100 miles south of Taiwan during Exercise Balikatan last month. So this is still definitely a part of the calculus here.
Sure. There's a lot going on, some of which we see.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Kevin. I appreciate it, and hope we'll see you in the future.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Kevin Nodell from the Honolulu Star Advertiser. Read more of his work at staradvertiser.com. June is Alzheimer's and Brain Awareness Month, and a new original play offers a local take on themes of memory loss and identity. Memory Beads is showing now at Kumukahua Theater. The play strings together scenes, or beads, from five generations of a family's history. Joni collects memory beads to counteract her fears that a family history of Alzheimer's disease will strike her mother or herself. Each scene is a bead sharing a story of immigration, unearthed genealogy, and self-acceptance. The cord that pulls the play together is the enduring relationships of mothers and daughters. Let's take a listen to two beads. The first features Joni and her daughter. The second, Joni and her mother.
I don't get why it's important.
Oh my God, I can't even believe it.
What? So you don't care?
Not really.
You should.
Should?
Why? Who we are now is made up of the past, of histories, of stories, of memories.
Sorry.
I guess our family's not so refined. Huh? It's like we're the leftovers.
No way. We have character. Because we didn't have it easy, we had to struggle. And that builds character.
Like you, Mom. You're a middle child.
And I have lots of character.
Oh, definitely.
You're not the oldest, so you got to be freer. You got to be yourself.
My mother didn't think about me much.
Local playwright Diane Aoki is behind the original production. She spoke with The Conversation's Lillian Song about turning her own experience as a caregiver into a reflection on the fragility of memory and the importance of family.
It's based on personal experiences about noticing or being responsible for my mom in her later years. And actually, there was a one-minute play festival that was put on probably 2016 or 2017, and I was invited to participate. I wrote it. It was back then it was called In Denial because it was about an elderly woman who was losing her hearing, but she didn't want to admit that she was losing her hearing. So it was about the daughter's frustration with her mom not facing that she needed the hearing aid. So that was the first scene that you'll see that scene in the play. But I kept working on it, adding another scene around this basic theme of losing your memory as you age. So I'd have different experiences with myself and with my mom that had to, that expressed that fear. You know, if you lose your memory, then what happens? Who are you? You know, so the idea of the play came to be about reclaiming the memories or saving the memories so that you can pass it on to the next generation.
So this play is based on personal experience. So the main characters are Joni, the main character, her daughter, Liana, and her mom, Haruko. And the title of this piece is Memory Beads. Can you tell me what that is about?
Well, you know, I am pretty much a traditional one, how I write. I write pretty linearly, you know, like there's a protagonist and the protagonist has a problem or an issue. Mm-hmm. And then they go through the journey as they kind of like work through this issue. This one was not linear. So it was about just capturing those memories, capturing those thoughts and stringing them together and trying to make sense of it. So it was a really big risk or departure from the way I usually write. So I hope that when people come to see it, that they're like not confused because it goes back and forth in time. There's actually two storylines. And so it breaks, the two storylines are broken up within the play. There's the story of Joni and her family. That's the one storyline.
Okay.
The other storyline is an Okinawan folktale.
Okay.
I had an uncle that was very much into genealogy. So a lot of what I learned about my genealogy came from his research. He traced us back in Okinawa to the 14th century. And in the beginning of this line, there's a story of the Celestial Maiden. I come to find out that this is a common theme in a lot of cultures, Chinese, Japanese, Okinawan. But anyways, it's in our genealogy. So it's the Celestial Maiden. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but this Celestial Maiden comes down to Earth and she's bathing in a stream and she's spotted by a farmer. The farmer steals her clothing. And then without her clothing, she can't return to her home. So he pretends to, you know, to sympathize with her and says that he's going to protect her. So she can't go back. So she stays with him, has two children with him. And then the dramatic issue is that she finds her robe. And will she go back or not?
Or love.
That's
the
question.
Has she found true love on Earth?
So that's one of the stories I weave into the other narrative of Joni and her family.
I see.
So, and then it goes back and forth in time.
You yourself were a caregiver with your mom, and this is a personal story. You have a daughter. You would really want to talk about the power of memory and also the fragility,
right,
as our brains age.
Yes, it's Joni and her family. Mm-hmm. It's a story about Joni, taken from some of my experiences and some of my family stories. But it's, you know, with plays, it's made up of scenes, right? So the scenes have their own stories. So I would recommend to people that come is just to take it one scene at a time, right? Whenever the scene appears, you say, okay, that scene is about a little girl who wants to be a nurse when she grows up, you know, and then it'll change. The next scene will be something different. So then you just kind of like switch gears. You say, okay, this scene is about this person who is having trouble finding her bearings being away from home. And then hopefully, the hope is that by the end of the play, it'll all be woven together mm-hmm. and that you'll have this aha moment and you see how all the memory beads connect.
As you're stringing these beads together, perhaps as I'm just watching it come together, it doesn't really make sense yet. But if I take your wisdom here, I was like, okay, I'll watch the scene and I'll park it. Wait for the next scene. And then pretty soon by the end of the play, though, this necklace of memory beads, because you've put it in the place that you have and you've strung it together. But when you put the clasp on it at the very end, it'll make sense.
Yeah. That's okay. The hope.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is also very timely because June is Alzheimer's and Brain Awareness Month. And for people, I want to say in our community here, we are blessed with longevity. But with longevity also comes with other things like as we age, our brains do encounter things like dementia, like Alzheimer's. And then our loved ones, how do we support them? How do we interact with them?
Yeah. That's one of the reasons I wanted to share this play, to have it produced, is because, I mean, there is nobody, I have not met one person who said, oh, I don't know what that's like. Everybody that I talk to says, oh, yeah, I went through that, or my mom, or my auntie, or my grandpa, or, you know, everybody seems to have a story of having to care for an elderly person who has declined. You know, their brain faculties have declined and they don't remember a lot of things. Like sometimes, I mean, into the extreme, they don't remember you, right? Mm-hmm. There's so much I learned after my mom passed about, you know, about caring for somebody in this condition. And it's so funny because I have a cousin and I always admired the way he took care of his mom. And then he tells me, no, I wish I had done more. I wish I had done more. And everybody says that. He says, no, I wish I had, I didn't do enough. So I had that. That was my feeling too, is that I wish I had done it differently. I wish I had done more. But that's the common thing, is that everybody feels like they should have done something different or something more, you know. So I guess I wanted to come to this resolution about how the best way that you as a caregiver can be a loving and kind caregiver. And so Joni's journey is that. I don't say she's aggressive, but she's just passionate. She's just like, she just feels this so strongly that she wants to collect these stories. And then it becomes, when you're too passionate, it becomes maybe annoying to the person, you know, or offensive to that person. They don't know why you're being so, you know, so intrusive, you know. So they interpret it as intrusive. You're nosy, you know. But there'll be hopefully people that come to see it will see how it's resolved, how I have come to a resolution mm-hmm. about how to care for one another in this condition.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so I had also asked you to maybe prepare a passage so that we would record and share that with our listeners. What passage have you chosen?
I've chose this. Most of my the play is conversation back and forth. They're just like short lines, but there's mm-hmm. only a few monologue-ish kind of passages. So I chose this one. This is about when. So like I said, that there's five generations. And so the main character is Joni, the daughter is Liana, and the mother is Haruko. And Haruko has a mother who came from Okinawa, so that's four. And then there's a scene where Kama is talking to her mother in Okinawa, so that's the five generations. Kama is told she has to go to Hawaii to marry this man from the same village. And she doesn't want to because she was in love with another man, but he passed away. So she's trying to decide what to do because she doesn't want to go. I could run away, but where would I run to? I would get caught and I would be returned to my family. He promised to send money to my family so we can pay our debts. I cannot see myself married to that old man. Okay, he's not very old, but to kiss him? He is not handsome like my Masami is, or was, and him taking me as his, as a man does to a wife? I know it will be that. Ugh, it is awful to think about, but what choice do I have? Is it a fate worse than death? Death? To join Masami?
You were saying you had to use your creative mind to put yourself into, okay, this was my ancestor,
right?
What she might have been thinking.
Right. See, this is the thing, is because they didn't share their stories, right? There's a lot that we don't know. So mm-hmm. I always wondered, you know, how she felt coming mm-hmm. to Hawaii. So yeah, I had to kind of create that. Yeah, that goes along with wanting the stories, but so many of our elders have passed already I wonder what they were thinking. I wonder what they felt. I wonder what their reason, you know, all of that. Mm-hmm. So I want to encourage people whose elders are still alive to not accept that they don't want to talk to you. Keep talking to them, you know, play games with them, Hanafuda or, you know, checkers or chess. Do something so that you can get their the conversation going, you know. The importance of making connections to your elders and getting their stories is the importance of knowing who you are in terms of your identity. So I think that there is a lot to be said for connecting to your ancestral culture, to learning more about them, to learning about what their migration story was, to learning about, like for my, in this case, about Okinawa and how, what the difference is between Okinawans and Japanese and, you know, and just kind of like exploring that part of your identity. So I'm hoping that thinking about the next generation, the generation beyond that, that they will still feel ties or feel connection, feel some kind of resonance with their ancestral line. So just be thankful that you have them still in your lives and try to get their stories.
That was playwright Diane Aoki and HBR's Lillian Song. Memory Beads will be playing on stage at Kumukahua Theater through June 28th. There will be a talk story with Aoki, the cast, and crew this Friday, June 5th, following the performance. That wraps it up for today. Tomorrow, we survey the condo industry in Hawaii. It's not just you. Owning a condo has gotten less affordable. Have you had to deal with skyrocketing fees? Share your comments or questions by leaving a message on our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Robbie Dingman, in for Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.